this episode of GeoTalk, we catch up with an Australian geocacher living in the US. We get a quick review on the Geocache Navigator, and we discover that humans really do walk in circles. All this and more on GeoTalk. Welcome to episode 51 of GeoTalk, and as you heard at the start of the podcast, it's a different theme music, and we figured we might start afresh with another 50 episodes. And my big thank you to Martin from the Hancock Clan here in Sydney, who put that together. He's done a fantastic job. He threw a few ideas my way, and I threw a few suggestions back, and that's the result. So I hope you enjoy it, and thanks once again to Martin for putting that together. A few things to go through. First of all, our monthly competition, thanks to geostore.com.au, where you can get all your geocaching gear online. And we got for this particular month, so for the month of August, is a DNF micro glow-in-the-dark coin and a bison tube. Oh, I hate those things. But look, if you want to put your name into the draw to win those, all you have to do is get in some audio for the month of August. Now, what we're going to do is, because we're falling a little bit behind, if you can get it in before show 52 and it gets played on either 51, this one here, or show 52, your name will go into a random draw to win the DNF glow-in-the-dark coin and the bison tube. And don't forget to head over to geocachestore.com.au. Their Tracker Bear travel dog tags have been walking out the door. They've been fantastic, and I've had a few people tell me how great they are. It's good to have an Australian version of a travel bug. A friend of mine pointed out a blog called the Apple blog, which had an entry called 11 geocaching iPhone applications. Now, a lot of people these days are using the iPhone to go geocaching, so this blog is worth checking out. It highlights or reviews 11 different caching applications, including the Toolkit, iGCT, Geocaching with Geosphere, iGeocacher, and of course GroundSpeak's geocaching application. I'll give you a link in the show notes, or head to the Apple blog. Now, some of you may know it's 2009 is International Year of Astronomy, and I've been involved in a few things this year. I went down to Canberra for the Apollo 11 40th anniversary celebration. It was quite a bit of fun catching up with some old faces I used to work with down at Tibimbilla. I've also helped out with the Great Aussie Star Hunt, or the Big Aussie Star Hunt, and hopefully a few of you also participated took some time to look at the night sky during National Science Week. Well, if you've missed out on any of those, you can still get your hands on an International Year of Astronomy GeoCoin, and they've been put together by DeVixen, or DeVixen selling them here in Australia. Angela in the ACT has got a website that also sells a number of other GeoCoins, and you can check it out at www.devixen, that's DVIXEN.com/GeoWatt, and she's got a whole range of different coins, including a really cool looking a guitar shape with an Australian flag on it. So check that out. But that's for the International Year of Astronomy coin. Great coin. It's got I think it's a set of two. On one of them, it's got the Anglo-Australia Telescope up in Coonabarabran, and on the other one, it's got the Gemini North Telescope in Hawaii. So I've actually been lucky enough to visit both. So I've got myself one, hopefully coming in the mail very soon. Those of you who are into photography and geocaching will probably know about the 12 of 12, and that's where you take 12 photos on the 12th of every month. And it's quite a fun project to get involved in. It's great to look back over the previous couple of months and years and see what you did on the 12th of each month. Well, Sunny and Sandy, along with Daryl W4 and Firefly03, have put together a bit of a project that's going to be running on the 12th of September. So here's a promo. Have a listen to this.
There's a fun worldwide event coming September 12th. It's another 12 of 12 photo day and prime season for geocachers to get out, find some caches, attend events, and share caching with the world.
We have some information about what you need to participate at geocaching12of12.com, but there's not much to it. Any camera, including a camera phone, will work. Then you just need to take photos of your day, pick the 12 best images that tell the story of your day, and post those someplace the world can see them.
We're really looking forward to seeing the photos of how you cache and with whom you're caching. With a 12 of 12 photos being shared worldwide, maybe we'll even get some others interested in joining us on the trail.
It's also a great chance to get some practice shooting photos while caching. Try methods to get yourself into the photos like many virtuals in EarthCache require. If you're at an event, get some photos of the games and the fellow cachers to include with your logs as well as posting with your 12 of 12 set. Just remember not to post spoiler photos of a cache. Try moving the container away from its home to get a photo of the cache with your team. Clever containers are great to share, but make sure you don't post information to give away which cache it is.
Don't forget that it's just fun, too. Check out geocaching12of12.com for information about joining in. How about a little photo tip for cachers to try before we get back to the show, Daryl?
We're all used to seeing the world at our own eye level. What about someone else? By getting low, you can get a view of the world from a child's level. At ground level, the world can look totally different. Give it a try and you'll grab some photos with a whole new look.
So that's the 12 of 12, which is occurring on the 12th of September in less than 2 weeks' time. So get your cameras ready for that. Now, another plug for a competition that we announced in last episode, and the entries are a little bit slow on this one, and a bit of a pity because there's some fantastic prizes to give away. If you go back to episode 50, you'll remember our interview with Keeper of Time from Dan and Woodend, and he's donated these wonderful little timepieces that he leaves in his caches, and he's given us three to give away on the podcast. And all you have to do is send in or phone in your story about your best time geocaching or something, anything to do with time and geocaching. So it could be when is the right time to go geocaching or when isn't the right time to go geocaching. All you have to do is email us your entry to geotalkpodcast@gmail.com or phone it in on 02850GEO. That's 850-436. Now, some of you may be aware that in my regular day-to-day job, I actually work for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation in their science unit. And the other day, we had a story that generated quite a lot of interest across our local radio stations. Now, rather than me talk about it on the podcast, I'm going to play a clip where I was chatting to Richard Glover from 702 in Sydney, all about researchers finding out that humans do walk in circles.
Darren Osborne joins us from ABC Science Online. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Richard. I hope I sound more convincing.
Yeah, well, that's right. We want you to be very realistic in your performance. Scientists have confirmed that the popular belief that without anything to guide us, we really will just walk round and round in circles.
Yep, that seems to be the case coming out of Germany from the Max Planck Institute. This actually started off as a viewer question to a science TV program in Germany, but the researchers over there have decided to take up the challenge. And they gathered two groups of volunteers together, one that they placed in a forest in Germany and the other in the desert in North Tunisia, and pointed them in a direction and said, go off for a couple of hours and see if you can get there and go in a straight line.
And so they didn't have the benefit of either compasses or an obvious view of the sun or the moon or anything?
No, well, they were able to use sort of the natural environment around them. So if the sun was out, they were able to use it, but they had no map, no compass. They had a GPS attached to them, but that was only in case they got lost and they needed to find them. Now, the findings that they came up with was if the sun was out, particularly in the forest, those were in the forest, they were able to stay in a pretty straight line, but as soon as the sun disappeared, that's when things went a bit haywire. They went to the left or the right. Now, the poor people who were dumped in the middle of the desert, they had a little less luck, particularly when the sun went down. In fact, one poor guy, in the middle of the night, he decided that he was going to loop back on himself and started heading in the opposite direction.
Now, why do they think it is that we naturally go in circles?
Well, the common theory, and this is one that they did decide to test out, is that one leg might be shorter than the other. Now, you might laugh at that suggestion, but if you've ever tried to get a new pair of shoes, you'll know that your shoe sizes aren't always identical. We're not symmetrical beings. But they found that when they tested that theory out, it doesn't work because sometimes we might veer to the left and other times we might veer to the right. And if we've had a few drinks, we might zigzag all over the place.
Okay, so throw that theory out.
Yeah, but the one that they think is that without any sort of visual cues, what we do is we rely on our muscles and our ears for balance, and little tiny errors that only have to be a fraction of a millimetre with each step over a period of a number of hours can add up, and that's where we start to drift off. So it might explain that poor backpacker that was up in the Blue Mountains, what happened to him.
Yes, yeah. But so does that mean that individuals, one individual tend to go to the right and another individual tend to circle around to the left?
No, we all seem to do it fairly randomly. If we all went in you know, each of us went in one particular direction all the time, then that might be something to do with our bodies. Mm. But yeah, it's just a very random thing. So the take-home message for this is that if you're out in the bush and you stupidly don't have a compass or a GPS with you, look for a landmark and stick to it.
Okay, good on you. Thanks very much.
Now, I did promise in this episode that we'd chat to a University of Melbourne researcher about turn-by-turn routing and some research he's doing. Unfortunately, we've got too much in this show to put in, so I'm going to hold it back for another week or so, and we'll put it in episode 52. So if you're holding out for that one, it shouldn't be too long, just another week or two about how the University of Melbourne is improving turn-by-turn navigation. And before we chat to Ozcacia from the US, it's time for the GeoTalk trivia question for this episode, and that is which geocaches in Australia and New Zealand have placed the most geocaches? The answer to that at the end of the podcast. Well, we're heading back to the US, but instead of heading to the East Coast or the West Coast, we're heading straight to the middle, to South Dakota, and we're catching up with an Australian who lives over there now, known by the name of David. We used to go by the call sign of VK2AAQ, but now is called Ozcacia. Welcome to GeoTalk, David.
Hey, thanks, Darren.
Now, first of all, tell us a little bit about what is an Australian doing in the state of South Dakota?
Well, about probably 8 years ago, I think it was around then, my wife and I moved over here for work, and she's from up in Minnesota, which is right next door to us, and we moved up here, and I, kind of settled here and had a really good job, and it moved me up here as well. So it's kind of how I ended up here.
And so where are you from in Australia?
Yeah, originally from Sydney out towards Rouse Hill.
Okay. So tell us a little bit, try and describe what it's like in South Dakota, what the terrain is like, the sort of, you know, the number of people, the population, so we can get a bit of an idea of where you're geocaching.
Okay. South Dakota, it's pretty flat where I am. I mean, it's not dead flat, like not like the middle of Australia, but, there's rolling hills and things like that, and there's a lot of areas where there's rivers and, you know, quite a few, I wouldn't say gorges, but bluffs and things like that, and some of them are kind of wide, some are kind of sharp cliffs, and there's, you know, a lot of rocks carved out, but not like the Blue Mountains or anything, but maybe like a flat plain, you'd be coming along a road and just find a river carved out through some rock and things like that. But Sioux Falls, where I am, is a population of about 150,000. The actual area and a few surrounding communities make it about 200,000. So you're probably looking at the size of maybe Wollongong or maybe Newcastle.
Right. I kind of get a picture, you know, the land sort of being a bit like the Riverina area around Wagga and those sorts of towns.
Yeah, pretty much. A lot flatter, would you believe? It's just, you get on the interstate here and head south, and the road's virtually dead straight for about 150 miles. You head west, it's straight, you know, zigzags a little bit, and it goes about 700 or 800 miles just dead straight virtually. And so, it's pretty flat land. It's probably the biggest killer around here because I'm used to seeing mountains and ocean and, yeah, it's not kind of boring scenery.
So add to that the fact that you're in the United States, which seems to have the highest caching density in the world. It must be a bit like shooting fish in a barrel when you go caching out there.
Well, it is, but it isn't. I mean, where we are, the town's fairly, you know, it's fairly big. It's probably about, you know, maybe 15 kilometres across by about maybe, I don't know, probably about 12, 15 on the north-south path there. And there's so many caches here that it's hard to put out any more. And now, after you clean kind of Sioux Falls out, I've got to kind of start driving to, country caches out in Iowa. And, you know, you drive 10, 15, 20 minutes between caches. And you know, lately, we've been driving to some other cities like Omaha, Nebraska, and Minneapolis and things like that. So, and that adds a bit of variety to it.
So in a typical weekend, how many caches would you find?
Well, this year I kind of increased my caching rate since winter, when caching drops down a fair amount in winter because there's so much snow around here, which I'll cover in a little bit. It's hard to explain, but I guess lately I've been finding between 50 and maybe 100, 120 every every week.
So it's still, so for someone who's in an area where you have to do a bit of travelling and it's not quite as cash dense, you still seem to be racking up the numbers at a fairly decent rate.
Well, yeah, I mean, last weekend I went down to a place called the Niobrara River in Nebraska and never been there. And, you know, just that 2 days alone, we racked up 130. But, you know, maybe next weekend we might only hit, you know, 20, 30, 40 caches. So, you know, it all adds up being an average.
So it must be great for an Aussie who's moved over to another country to go geocaching, because you'd probably be exploring more than a lot of the locals.
I actually explained that to some guys at work yesterday because they're talking about some things. And I said, yeah, I know what that is, and I know what that is. And I said, you'll probably know more of the local terrain within 2 or 3 hours of here than anybody in this building, or, you know, maybe 95% of the people. And after talking to a few people, I very much doubt that, you know, many people know as much as I do of the local terrain.
Tell us about how you got into geocaching. Did you first find out about it while you were living in the US, or was it before you headed over?
I found out about it about 3 years ago. A little over 3 years ago, I was at a ham radio meeting. I'm a ham radio operator, hence my original caching name. And they did a little demo one time on these guys who had a couple of caches out there. And I said, oh, I might give this a try. And my daughter was born, who's just over 3 now. And a week later, I kind of got a little bit of stonewall and crazy in the house. Thought, oh, I need to get out and have a breath of fresh air. And, you know, here's one over here. I might go for a hike. And went out, and that's where it started, and kind of went from there.
So for any Australians who are thinking of going over to the US, whether it's to live or for holiday, are there any sort of tips, any sort of things that you think Australians should take into account when they're wanting to go geocaching in the US?
There's a couple of differences over here. Like in Australia, which some of the funny things I find is actually you walk through the bush here and you come across a, I don't know why they do it. You've got an ammo can out in the middle of nowhere and you come across a big pile of sticks. You pull the sticks apart and there's an ammo can under it. You go to Australia, you're walking along and you find a big pile of rocks. You know, there's quite a bit of difference in caches too, just what people are doing. I'm sure a lot of people are caching in downtown Sydney and that. And, you know, you've got a few skyscrapers, but I mean, I've cached in New York and a few other larger cities like Los Angeles and that. I've never seen a GPS throw me out by like 3 or 4 blocks away. I was in Philadelphia last year, and only because I knew the name of the place where it was, I knew where to search. But my Garmin 60CSX, which has got a pretty good antenna on it, it's showing me 3 blocks away on my map, and it was a plus or minus, it was about 120 meters. You know, some of the areas you go to, I mean, I haven't been to too many bad areas, and you can kind of tell when you take a wrong turn somewhere in some of these larger cities, thinking maybe I'll jump in the car and head that way until I see a little more favorable area, so you're not... not in the wrong type of climate, if you know what I mean there. So it's but it's not too bad. I mean, I've really had a great time out there and rarely found any of those type of areas. Most of them have been pretty nice, and you know, 99.9% of the time they've been, you know, pretty safe areas.
I suppose the other question then that lends from that is there a different attitude towards caching in Australia and the US?
Well, it's a little bit different every location. Some people treat it as a real serious hobby. Other people are just, you know, they kind of do it just randomly on the side and go out and do it. So I think there's a lot more serious caches over here. And generally talking about caches themselves or people, mugglers are actually a bit different over here as well. You go to Australia, kind of doesn't really matter where you cache. People kind of mind their own business and don't really look at what you're doing. And a lot of the medium to smaller towns, you know, Sioux Falls or any town smaller, doesn't matter where you are, if you're out trying to look for a cache, people are kind of always inquisitive and staring at what you're doing. Or I've noticed, you know, you go back to Sydney, some of the smaller towns, even in Brisbane where I've gone to, people kind of just leave you alone and mind their own business. Whereas, you know, you come over here to these smaller towns, they tend to be inquisitive, and it's a little harder to find some of these caches.
We hear a lot of stories from the US of sort of police encounters, law enforcement encounters. I mean, have you had any of your own?
I have had, I'm going to count them here, about 6 encounters here of law enforcement. A couple I've kind of avoided. there was one in California. We were out there just having a great time. My friend and I went out and hit a 241 caches in a day. Started at 5 a.m. and 5:20 a.m. and finished at midnight. And a dusk along one of the highways between Bakersfield and somewhere else. We were there and hear a voice, and my friend says, come up here, and I knew what the voice was, and I get up there, and there's Chips, California Highway Patrol. You guys okay? And yeah, we're out finding caches, little things people put out here, and looked at the GPS, and he smiled and said, oh, have a good day, and I think he ran out plates, and he jumped in the car and ran off, and we told him we appreciated his help stopping and checking on us.
Obviously, the police and a lot of the community in the US, well, in your city in particular, have an awareness of geocaching. I mean, how important do you think it is, you know, letting people like that know and building up relationships?
I mean, it's pretty important. I mean, we sent a couple of letters off a few years ago to the local police here, and yeah, Christmas Day a few years ago, I was walking up to a tree which was covered in Christmas lights, and it's like 11 o'clock in the morning, and there's snow everywhere, and I'm looking for a cache my friend put out for a first to find, and police cars down the road, and I'm looking, and he must have thought I was stealing the lights or something, and he starts walking up the hill, and I walk down to him, and obviously people are doing something wrong. They don't walk towards the police if they're doing something wrong. And so I might ask, what you're doing? And he said, well, I'm looking for a geocache. You ever heard of it? And he said, well, funny thing is, we got a memo a couple of weeks back about that. And yeah, that's fine. Yeah, no worries. Have a good day. And he walked off. And so it really helped there. And two other police cars turned up, and you know, nothing else to do on Christmas Day. And they wanted to help him out. And they all chuckled and laughed in the corner and kind of watched me search and then took off.
Mm. Now, just briefly, we mentioned in a previous episode that we found a Where I Go cache out at Rouse Hill, which is the one that you set up. Tell us quickly, how was it sort of putting together a Where I Go cache, and what sort of tips might you give to someone who's thinking of doing the same?
Well, it's kind of an experience setting one up. I had a friend of mine help me. He's put about six of them out now, and it's a little bit different how you set it up. Things are kind of related to other things, and it's a very, very temperamental program, and if you make one little mistake and you're loaded into a Colorado or Oregon or you know a PDA or anything, and you don't test it right, you may press one button and it messes up for everybody. So it's a difficult. They're kind of difficult to make. Once you kind of get used to it, they're obviously a little easier to make, but there are a lot of work involved. Even the basic one at Rouse Hill, it's only a very short basic one, which I made for an introduction. Which you know, it's just trying to get people interested and maybe create some more of their own there. And so if you know, if you're going to give it a go, you got to have a lot of time to sit down and read it and go over it. I mean, some of these Where I Go's can take 15 or 20 hours to make just to get your head around how it's put together.
Yeah, it seems to me when I've tried to put one together, you got to do it. You got to spend a lot of preparation work. It's a bit like computer programming. You can't just sort of start typing it up straight away. You've really got to put pen to paper.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just. I mean, they look easy when they're built. I mean, okay, there's a couple of words here, but it's amazing how many items you got to have a location for it, a zone for it, and this zone. And you move out of one, and another one gets activated, and you make sure that one turns off. And, you know, if you grab something, this guy grabs it. And it's just there's a whole range of things. And if you forget to just do one of them, and unless you test every aspect of it, you can, you know, you could put it out there for a year, and somebody presses the wrong button or something, or somebody, you know, picks up a map virtually. This is... instead of maybe a torch or something, and they pick up the map and the whole game crashes.
Well, it seems that you've had quite a range of experiences in geocaching in just such a short span of time, I suppose, you know, in the last 3 years. What sort of goals have you got set for yourself over the next year or two?
I don't really have any goals. I was just out there enjoying myself and trying to cache as much as I could lately because, as I said, you kind of get stonewall crazy in winter and, you know how many caches you find kind of goes down unless you can find a period with not much snow on the ground that warms up or you go somewhere. So, yeah, my goal was just to, you know, go out and cache as much as I could and then to kind of get bored of it or want to have a break, do that. But I went out there and kind of march and ramp things up and haven't kind of been bored since. So, but, you know, goals just to just get out there and have fun and do something different and maybe go to a few locations differently, looking at going to Canada, caching sometime later in the year, so that might be a little bit different as well. So, and that may be a little bit different in the US.
And are there any plans to head back to Australia to do some caching down here?
I'm looking at going back maybe the next 6 months and cache down there. I don't just go back for caching. I go back there to visit family. And it's kind of a bit of a toss up between family and trying to you know balance that out and seeing friends and you know because it can take a lot of time up and I just don't want to go back and. Not visit family, but not find any caches either, so.
Well, hopefully when you do make your way back down and you're not tied too closely to family and friends, we might catch up with you and maybe even squeeze in a few caches along the way. Dave, thanks very much for joining us on Geo Talk, and all your best caching in the summertime up in the US.
Yeah, no problem at all. Thank you.
Now it's time to go around the country and have a look at some of the events that are occurring. On the 6th of September is the September Springtime Meet and Greet that's being held by Sol de Lune in Canberra. Now there's a couple of events on the 9th of September. On the 9th is the Flipper & Co. 999 Quickie Caches Quiz and Supper by Flipper & Co. in Adelaide. There is the 999 multi-event in Perth in Western Australia being held by Allied Oz and the Jokers. And there's the 999 by 999 Hell's Kitchen by Backpacker down in Melbourne. Also on the 13th of September is the Bris Vegas Meet and Greet by Just a Trifle. And on the 13th of September is the City Circle Scramble in Melbourne by Team Crackers and the Spruce Mooses. Don't forget, if you want to give your event a plug, go to the GeoTalk website at geotalkpodcast.com, drop us an email, or phone in your little promo on 02 800 50 436. Time now to go into the Geo Talk mailbag. Got a few emails for this episode. First of all, one from Jeremy, aka Norkmeister. Now, he says he's got a tip for us about the Geocache Navigator. He says he's up to 127 finds now, and he's done them all on his Nokia E71 mobile phone. And he says he's got a message about the he got a message recently about the free trial for Geocache Navigator expiring in early September. So he decided that to take up the upgrade, which costs €15, which is about 30 Australian dollars. He said he was happy to find that Geocache Navigator now supports the saving of results, of search results. But it still has a long way to go, he says, because it limits you to only 25, and it doesn't seem to save them into a database like Smart GPX, which you can actually use on Nokia as well. Rather, you end up having to name the search results, and then you can browse that set. Now, he says one other gripe he does have is that it doesn't download the logs for those caches. But he says it's a heck of a lot better than having no offline ability, so being able to save those cache descriptions. He says he's gotten around some of the limitations by saving the 25 nearest caches based on different categories. So say 25 that are closest to home that are traditional and the 25 multis that are closest. So anyway, he says now he's got all that sorted out. He's up for a trip and he's about to head up into the mountains to Nimadgee, and he won't have to worry about no mobile service while he's up there. I got another email from Ian and Daff, known as the Swaggies. He said they listened to the show earlier this year when I gave a tip about making pocket queries when you go to an event. And that's been quite a popular one. I've shown that to a number of people. And they say that it's quite a useful tool, and they use it all the time whenever they're visiting an area to do caches, not just at events, but any cities or towns that they happen to be visiting in their travels. And they said they used to spend a lot of hours at night staring at the yellow labels in Aussie Explorer and then going to GSAC to find the corresponding cache and mark it as a cache to visit and so forth. Anyway, they say that it takes them about 30 minutes on average to do, which is saving them about 3 nights of preparation for when they're going away. So thanks for the tip, and keep up the good work. Well, thanks, Ian and Daff. If you want to check out that tip, I'll give a link in the show notes at geotalkpodcast.com, and where you can go back and find that one. And hopefully then, like Ian and Daff, you'll be able to simplify your planning for your next weekend away. And here's a couple of calls that were sent into the GeoTalk phone hotline.
GeoTalk listeners, it's HGL here from Adelaide. I just wanted to report on the new Aussie Tracker Bears. I got my first one from Geocache Store, and they look fantastic. I've created the first my first traveller with it, called Adelaide Panda, to commemorate the pandas arriving at Adelaide Zoo, hopefully later this year. And I want to say thanks to Zoe and the guys at Geocache Store for a fantastic idea and some and the fantastic service that they are great at. So thank you very much, and enjoy, and thanks for the podcast. Bye.
GeoTalk listeners, I'm Richard from Team Fudley. Just wanted to say thanks to all those that attended the 2009 Cyber Flash Mob event on GCA. It was a great event, and amongst the mayhem and confusion, I think everyone enjoyed it. There were some excellent posts made, all of which were very positive. The event received 113 attended logs, and we managed to achieve 123 users online at one time. The winners of the Geo Coins were Camstill, who got the first to find coin, Mundo got Garden Gorilla's Gone Bush coin, and the Meerkats got the 2009 Northern Territory coin. Thanks to those who donated coins, and thanks to everyone for attending. See you at the next one.
Hi, it's been the bottom. I'm a train to nowhere. I'm having a fun time talking with the cage. DNFing the cage, actually. You've been cool. DNFing the cage. Fun. Yeah, well, hope I find the cage. I keep walking. Yeah, bye.
You want to send in your own voicemail, and it could be for a milestone or an announcement or a review. Don't forget to type into your mobile phone now and save it. GeoTalk 02-850-436. That's 850-436. And everyone that sends in an email that gets read out or sends in a voicemail that's played on the show, each month goes into the draw to win a prize from geocachestore.com.au. Well, that's all for this episode of Geo Talk. Before we go, better give you the answer to the trivia question. Which geocaches in Australia and New Zealand have hidden the most number of caches? Well, on top of the list is Bits Prayer, with hidden at 403 geocaches. Money Dork, who's also from New Zealand, with 270. Fredo with 237. Glyn, the only one, with 207. And Rob Taz with 206. So they're the top hiders. Better give them a big thank you. In the next episode, we're going to head down the coast, head down to Wollongong and Kiama to find some earth caches and a Where I Go cache, and we're going to go to university a little bit later than we expected to find out how researchers are improving turn-by-turn routing. Until next time, safe geocaching.